they open their minds to understand the scriptures. As far as the disciples knew, Jesus was dead. They knew this because they had seen with their own eyes his crucified body, because they had heard with their own ears his last word, because with their own hands they had touched his cold flesh as they prepared him for the tomb. They knew the way we know, the difference between life and death. What was it then that changed everything they knew about the death they would die and about the life they were destined to live? How did it happen that these who knew the facts the way we know the facts, because they had seen with their eyes, heard with their ears, touched with their own hands, how did it happen that their minds were opened to know Jesus Christ and his resurrection, as Paul was later to write, to know Jesus Christ and the power of his resurrection? How is it that they came to know in him the truth that set them free from the power of death? Well, certainly the appearances of the stranger on the Emmaus Road, the same stranger that terrified and startled the 11 like a ghost in Jerusalem, was part of it. And even though seeing, hearing, and touching his resurrected presence almost fit their ways of knowing him before he was dead, something was inconceivably different about knowing him now. Still, this was not the half of it. In both lessons this morning, we read that the disciples' minds were opened as Jesus interpreted the things about him in all the scriptures. We read that as he was at table with them and took bread and blessed it and broke it, their eyes were opened and they recognized him. Something about God's living word, interpreting the words of scripture, something about his living presence, breaking bread with them, changed everything they knew about the death they would die and about the life they were destined to lead. Well, the same scriptures are before us this morning. And the table, though not set, reminds us of him at table breaking bread. And his living presence is among us. How is it that he had come along? How is it that he comes alongside us too, even now, and waits to open our minds to his living presence and to a wholly different way of knowing that begins with knowing the power of his resurrection? First, I think we need to get something straight or slant about knowing the truth. To ask after truth is not, in the first place, to set out in search of the facts. The question of truth is a question of faith. It is a question born of faith. To be a human being, says John Leith, is to live by faith. There is no other alternative. The events of life compel us to faith commitments, whether explicit or implicit, conscious or unconscious. Each day before we have been up 3 hours, we have made decisions in the light of some faith commitment about the nature of the universe, about the nature of being which the facts are understood. So it's not just that we get up and test everything by seeing, tasting, touching, hearing, but there is a prior leap that has to do with what we say is most basic about being human. And it is that leap that requires faith, requires a relationship of trust. Make no mistake, scientists, no less than preachers, live by faith. Live in the light of certain experiences or events that reveal to us the real nature of human existence and the world. So that prior question would then be, what is the revelatory event or events which provides the clue to the meaning of all other experiences? What revelation will hold the clue, in the words of H. Richard Niebuhr, that enables us to put together the disparate experiences of life into a meaningful, coherent whole? To see a pattern and purpose in human history, to overcome the incongruities between what life is and what life ought to be. The story of the Emmaus Road is a story about the faith in the light of which the truth of human existence is understood. A story about the revelatory experience which has provided Christians with the clue to the meaning of every other experience since Jesus was raised from the dead. Hidden in this story is a different way of knowing. Listen again. Two of the disciples were on the way back to the human condition, unredeemed, talking with each other about all these things that had happened, trying to understand their lives in the face of a devastating death. They were talking as we talk on the road to nowhere in particular, talking about what we should make of the troubles we've seen, of our friend's premature death, of problems at the office or a series of strange instances that have led us to question our direction, or the reason beneath some unwarranted suffering, or if there were something more behind a chance encounter. We're talking about the big questions on the road to Emmaus, on the road back to our lives, unredeemed. We talk about these things on the way to the grave. Now and again, we may even stumble upon some reasonable explanation that seems to make sense of the disparate facts, a plot of sorts, a psychological analysis that rings true and resonates with our unconscious, or a chance alignment of the stars, say, leading us 1,000 years makes absolutely no difference. In this regard, that we were not there on that road, that we were not gathered in that upper room, makes absolutely no difference. His word is before us. His living presence is among us. And he is here, through those words, trying to turn us and our lives toward his living presence. So it was, and so it is, that his surprising presence opens our minds to a way of knowing the truth born of faith, born of a relationship. Is given to us to turn us toward his living presence. I believe, says Caleb in the midst of narrating the story of his family's life lived east of Eden, I believe that there is one story in the world, and only one. Humans are caught in their lives and their thoughts, in their hungers and ambitions, in their avarice and cruelty, and in their kindness and generosity too, in a net of one story. That story is what the church calls Scripture. And according to Robert Jensen, the church reads her Scripture as a single, plotted succession of events stretching from creation to consummation, plotted around the Exodus and resurrection. Give me a used Bible, says Caleb's friend Samuel a bit later on, and I will, I think, be able to tell you about a person by the places that are edged with the dirt of seeking fingers. Liza, he adds, wears a Bible down evenly. My guess is most of us wear a Bible down, not much at all. Or if we do, we wear it down using it for what it is not. A set of rules, a collection of sayings, an ancient text about religion, a compendium of inspiring literature. And we miss the revelatory experience that it mediates. The story whose plot determines our days. The tale told not by an idiot, but by an almighty author who has written himself into the story in the person of Jesus Christ. Would that the dirt of our searching fingers were all over these words that tell us of him, and so of the human being we were born to be. Would that the dirt of our searching fingers were evenly spread across these pages, which unfold a plot more merciful than we can ask or imagine. Back then to the pages, to the Emmaus Road, and to those two characters who have seemingly lost the thread of the plot, as have we. Another character joins them, the same character that joins us as the dirt of our seeking fingers turns the page. What are you discussing with each other while you walk along? He asks us, all of us. What are you talking about? What's going on with your life? Where are you struggling? What are your big questions? Truth be told, without him, we have no clue about these things we have been discussing. No clue about the things we have been taught, the stories we've been told, the miracles we have witnessed, the words he has said, the death 3 weeks since Easter Sunday, and though the woman saw a vision and said he was alive, we cannot say for a fact that we have seen him ourselves. Really? Again, Jesus says to them, even as he says to us now, "Oh, how foolish you are. How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe." Ain't it the truth? And beginning with Moses and the prophets and the Psalms, he interprets to them the things about himself in all the scripture. Beginning with Moses, the Exodus, and the prophets, he tells us the plot of God's saving purposes in human history. I repeat, Revelation is the clue that enables us to put together the disparate experiences of life into a meaningful, coherent whole, to see a pattern and a purpose in human history, to overcome the incongruities between what life is and what life ought to be. In other words, as we find ourselves on some Emmaus road talking together about the incongruities of our lives, I know we do, you and I do all the time, this one who joins us and listens is the revelatory experience, the one in whom and through whom all things hold together, the one by whose life, death, and resurrection our minds are opened. Unless it should happen ages and ages hence that religion should close our minds in his name. But that is another sermon. By faith, and faith alone, we may see, really see, what without him we could not see. The light which follows darkness, the life which follows the defeat of death, the promised land which awaits us as we plod through the wilderness of our exodus or exile. A father, way down the road, whose open arms are waiting exactly for you. If you just turn around, head home. The claim of the Christian faith and of the church throughout the ages is unequivocal. In this story, the reality of our life and our death cohere with the reality of God's person and purpose and promise. The question remains is whether we will spend our days in lively engagement with its author, in common pursuit of the chapters yet to be written in our own lives, in daily gratitude for the companionship afforded us by this ragtag group of characters, and in some degree of humility given the bit part we have been asked to play as undeserving members of God's eternal cast. Will we? Or will we go on living as though our human existence were a tale told by an idiot signifying nothing? To choose the former, to choose to inhabit the story, to choose to turn to him whose interpretation of that story is the story of our lives, is, says Robert Jensen, to choose to hang out with Scripture on a particular corner, the corner where there is a little crowd gathered around someone telling about the resurrection. But it is getting on toward evening, and given another way too long sermon, the day is now well spent. If, as the story goes, those who think it all to be a tale signifying nothing were to be invited in and gathered around some table, say this table, and if, as the story goes, bread were broken, well, I don't want to ruin the ending. Best we keep reading, trusting that his living presence will open our minds to a whole new way of knowing. Thank you. speak to God.